A general note for clarification, in the following interviews, you may hear those interviewed refer to learning mindsets as academic mindsets. The field around learning mindsets and skills is constantly shifting, and so too is our vocabulary. Recently, the Raikes Foundation conducted extensive research regarding the field and arrived at the title Learning Mindsets and Skills, Empowering Students to Unlock Their Potential. Rest assured that whether those interviewed are referring to academic mindsets or learning mindsets and skills, they are talking about the same thing. Welcome to the Learning Mindsets and Skills Massive Open Online Course Podcast Series. This series is brought to you by the High Tech High Graduate School of Education with support from the Raikes Foundation on the Coursera On Demand MOOC platform. Details about this massive open online course, as well as other courses offered by High Tech High, can be found at www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs. That's www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs. Our focus in week two is on measurement and assessment for academic mindsets. In our first podcast, we revisit our speaker from the week one conversation with Camille Farrington, as well as her ill-fated hiking trip. During her keynote speech, Camille brought up sense-making.
Primary goals. So sense-making, there's two primary goals in sense-making, and the first of this is that we just want things to be kind of consistent. So we see things as consistent because that's the way we want them to be. We want the world to be a stable place that is predictable so that we can feel like we have some control over what's going on. We have an incredible need to feel like the world makes sense, and so we impose sense upon it. The second piece is that we make sense of things in a way that maintains our own self-regard or that makes us feel like we're competent people. And so we see the world in ways that are going to kind of keep these two things consistent. But when push comes, well, let me give you, for classrooms, now this, in some of my research, talking to kids, I studied kids failing school, so kids who had failed in ninth grade and were still in school, very low probability of graduating, but they didn't know that, and I was trying to understand how they make sense of failure and how they make sense of their schooling experience. And one thing that became really clear to me is that where a teacher might see that student as somebody who is kind of a disruptive and kind of a clown and that kind of, and that from the teacher's perspective, this is a failing student that is, you know, clowning around and really doesn't have any skills and that kind of thing. But from the kid's perspective, they did not experience the classroom like that at all. What they experienced in the classroom is a place where they could exercise their social competence, and that they, what they were paying attention to were all the social cues across, you know, going on back and forth across all of the different kids in the class, because that was the world in which they felt competent. They understood what was going on in that world, and when they walked into the classroom, it was a social situation, and they were reading the social cues, and they felt fine about themselves, where the teacher saw them in a very different light. So the idea that we kind of see the world in a way that's going to help us feel good about ourselves. But when push comes to shove, people will give up the second thing in favor of the first. And so there's been research studies where there's calamities and various catastrophes or things that happen to people. They will take blame for those things and say, well, I screwed up, or it was my fault, or I did something that caused this thing, because they would rather give up their self-regard than to accept the notion that the world is just a precipitous place where just any random thing could happen. And so in order to maintain the illusion that they have some control and that the world makes sense, that, you know, something didn't happen and, you know, kill their loved ones or destroy their house, just some random event, that to put that in a frame that made sense, they would take personal responsibility for things that weren't, in fact, their fault. The other thing on sense-making is that it is unrelentingly social, that we can't just make up any old story to make sense of what's going on with us. we basically have to come up with a plausible story, and we choose those plausible stories out of stories that are made available to us to choose. And so we can't just, so kids, when I was talking to kids about failure, they gave very typical kinds of stories. I'm lazy. I don't work hard enough. The teacher is really bad. Stuff happened outside of my life that made it that I couldn't go to school. I mean, they were really kind of plausible stories. They were the stories that were available to them to choose from to explain. What they didn't say is, school as an institution is you know, fundamentally flawed. And they didn't say the whole adult world that believes that this is a place that's a, you know, valuable and that this education and credentialing is a meaningful thing, that's just wrong. They took it upon themselves or to feel like it was their fault somehow that they weren't making it through this institution. So this notion of what are the available stories to us, how do we perceive what's going on? And so thus far we've been talking mostly about psychology, like how we perceive stuff. But the flip side of that is what is around us in terms of how can we make sense of these things. So the stories that we tell ourselves, which you can think of as our mindsets, really fundamentally shape the way we see the world. And so the glass half empty and the glass half full person has a story to explain the phenomenon of life, and that's the way they see everything. So and that will continue until it is disrupted. So if I think that I'm looking north, then I am going to be absolutely sure that I'm looking north until something, and even when the facts are clear that I'm not, something has to totally disrupt it. And it wasn't until we were totally lost in hiking for 11 miles and didn't know where we were that I was like, okay, well, maybe I was wrong. So you kind of have to. And I think Chris Emden did a great job on whatever day we started out here on Wednesday, talking about disruptive stories, right? He was talking about driving. It wasn't until he saw a little 2-year-old making fun of his driving and yelling at people out the fake window that he realized he was kind of an erratic driver. It wasn't until his kids showed him videos of him yelling and screaming at everybody that he realized, oh, well, maybe I yell a lot. That you need some kind of disruptive experience to make you see how the story that you are stuck in and the way that you see the world.
So now that we've made sense of sense-making, so to speak, what about measuring good practices and behaviors? We asked Camille how she and her colleagues went about this.
Some of the good practices or great things I've seen schools be engaged in. So one is the idea of belonging is to really have a small group of kids, so whether it's an advisory or in a crew or, you know, whatever you call that you have a small group of, you know, 15 kids who spend part of every day together with an adult that is, you know, that's their team, and they're going to meet with each other on a regular basis, like a daily basis, and have a space where kids can talk about things outside of class that impacts, you know, just their life, like what's going on with them and how that's impacting their engagement at school, and set up just the norms of we help each other get through this stuff. And having just a home base seems to matter a lot. So that's one thing that schools can do, is just make sure that you've created a space where every kid has a home base in school. In terms of the idea of self-efficacy and growth mindset, a lot of that has to do with, I'm convinced, has to do with grading practices and just instructional practices. So if what we do, as a teacher, I say, okay, like this is what we're trying to learn. This is a really hard thing to do. It's going to take a lot of work and practice to get there, and I know you're not there now. And so here we're going to bring in models of what a good example of this, you know, done well would look like. And you're going to practice, and you're going to practice, and I'm going to give you feedback on what you're doing. And I'm not going to grade you on it until you can do it, right? You know, like once you've gotten to the point where you've demonstrated you can really do this, and whether it's writing an essay or whether it's a particular kind of, you know, solving some kind of math problem or whether it's creating some final presentation or something, that you're just going to keep working on it until it is as, you know, as high a quality of a product as it could possibly be. And to really give kids the space to try, do it wrong, try again, really work on some kind of meaningful product is how you build self-efficacy and how you build growth mindset. And I'll contrast that with, I'm going to teach you, you know, we're doing, you know, unit 1, pages 1 through 10 today. We're going to read through it. You're going to have do the questions at the end, and then we're never going to we're going to move on to the next thing, and then, you know, 10 days from now we're going to do a test on all of it. And then we have to move on to something else because we have this content coverage stuff that we have to move through. So kids don't feel like I can succeed at this, because if they don't get it right away, there really isn't another opportunity to get it. And it also sends the message to kids that either it's not that important that you get it, because I know you failed at this or you got a C on this, but that doesn't matter, because what's more important is that we move on to the next thing. So that sends the message, one, that like I don't, you know, we don't, it's not that important that you learn this, or we don't really believe you can learn it any better than that anyway. And it really undermines that notion that, you know, I can succeed and that my hard work is going to pay off.
Finally, with all this knowledge on steps to consistently evaluate mindsets, how can we bring this to scale for perspective?
I think there's a couple different ways. There's a couple different ways to bring to scale the idea of academic mindsets. And to some extent, it really is just a way of thinking about your work as an educator. And so the more that a teacher in a school has other teachers in the school with whom they can engage in conversations about academic mindsets and how are we creating a space that kids want to be there, they want to engage in the work, and, you know, what are the conditions that make that possible? I think just so one way to scale that is just for educators to engage in those conversations with each other, and it's just really just a way of thinking about the work that they do. And I really want to emphasize that it's not necessarily teaching academic mindsets, so it's not content that you're trying to present to kids so much as it's things that you should be keeping in your mind always as an educator about how am I creating the conditions for learning in my classroom. And as I say, like the more that you have other like-minded folks to bounce those ideas off of, and then, you know, kind of hopefully grow that organically, you know, within a school. But it's really important for school leaders to understand the research around academic mindsets and to think about how school leaders are creating conditions for teachers to engage in that work and to create those kinds of experiences for kids in the classroom. And I do an exercise with teachers and school administrators that's around supports and thwarts. Like, what are you doing that support these kinds of experiences and practices? And what is in the school building that thwarts that? And how can you systematically try to get the thwarts out of the way so that people can feel more engaged in what's going on? So on one level, I think that's the kind of school change model. And then the other scaling thing is to just create other examples of schools. And this tends to be easier with a school that you start anew, you know, if you're starting a new school, is to really figure out how do you fundamentally build around these ideas at every step of constructing a school. It's always harder to change an existing institution than it is to just start from scratch. But I think it's important that both things are happening. The start from scratch model gives you models of that, you know, what that would look like if you kind of full blown what that might look like. And then if you're in a traditional school, you can think about, well, how can we start moving incrementally towards that, what that looks like.
This podcast and other podcasts like it is available through Libsyn, which allows you to listen to podcasts on iTunes as well as all other podcast dissemination services. To access our library of podcasts, visit www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs and click on the podcast logo. That's www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs and click on the podcast logo.